line payoff often for the translation are the tricky parts that are resolved. And that form of resolution feels so good, you know, and when it's validated by, you know, a great editor, in this case, the editors of Rendition, who are these very well-known and highly respected Hong Kong editors, for a young Howard Goldblatt, who I'll mention, I'll tell you more about him in a second, you know, that would have been exhilarating, right? So to have these letters to go through and understand that process is so rich and helps us understand so much about the, not just the novella and its transmission to English, but translation itself, or about the relationship of editors to translators, or about Hong Kong as a space, or about this particular translator. And it's that idea of a particular translator becoming important that I want to spend a couple of seconds on. So Howard Goldblatt is the translator of Moyan, who won, of course, the Nobel Prize in 2012. Before he won the Nobel Prize in 2012, there were nearly 10 dissertations written on him. Now, if you think about literary figures writing in English today, you know, today, not before, today, how many of them are having dissertations written on them? You know, actual well-known authors. Not so many, because typically it requires a kind of aging process before that, you know, someone becomes canonical and then becomes a topic of a dissertation. There's a period of time that we're waiting for that. So he already was a figure being studied. But what did the dissertation look like? And they were very similar to one another. Here is the original Chinese version. Here is Howard Goldblatt's English version. I'm going to now guess what went right and what went wrong, because I'm going to evaluate the English based on its proximity to my reading of the original. And then there'll be this kind of gotcha stuff, like, oh, you got this wrong. You know, which is often kind of tinged with sort of Westerners don't understand kind of idea. But then also the reverse of that, which is a kind of, it's now better. So Moyan became better in English than he is in Chinese, which is something that of course Moyan never liked hearing. And I think is for good reason. I wouldn't want to hear that either. Nor do I believe it, because they're so different. They're apples and oranges, right? So how do you deal with comparison when comparison is an inadequate theoretical model, you know, to entice data from. And yet that was the one happening over and over again, because there's very little to do. Introduce translation theory, we can talk about domestication or foreignization, and I'm gonna put that to the end. But you can theorize the work, but with very little to study, you are stuck in a holding pattern, and translation studies typically remains there due to a lack of preservation. So these historical spaces are simply so vulnerable because translators themselves do not know that they should be. Howard was so young, so unfamous at this time, but happened to have held on to this priceless material, and so on. This is the reading space at the University of Oklahoma for the translation archive. There are two wings that are being remodeled right now, open up next month. And this has been switched. Here's our screen here. But includes all of Howard Goldblatt's personal library. And so one of the things I'm doing is collecting personal libraries of translators to recreate those environments. So it's about 10,000 books that he had in his home that he would have been referencing when he's talking, or when he's doing his work, and he annotates some of them and so on. But when you come into this non-circulating collection, you would be able to access anything in his intellectual environment that you would want to know. I've also collected Arthur Whaley's personal library. And so you go back into the Qing Dynasty materials, which we'll see in a second, and you can kind of start to see his indexing methodologies and so on. So this is some of Arthur Whaley's material. And to imagine that this is a working text, right? We're talking about movable, printed, puncture thread, side-stitched materials from, this is, the publishing house went out of business in the late Qing, so it's probably early mid Qing Dynasty book that he actually used, and a lot of his material are side stitched and very vulnerable to weathering because they are not acid free and they haven't been held in a curatorial archive space. So I'm going to just tell you a few things about this collection. So this is Arthur Whaley's annotated version of Ezra Pound's Cathay. For me, this is like the whole reason I did this business. This is a perfect fetish object for me. Ezra Pound writes this book and publishes it in 1915. most American poetry scholars, or many anyway, would argue it's the first book of American modern verse, let alone that it's a translation, but that the style of the Venice tactic structures and the rhetorical devices that he's using and employing here, as understood as being borrowed from the Chinese set of precedent for English verse, which loosely was called vorticism or imagism and others, but very important work. What I did not know is that Arthur Whaley on the other side of the Atlantic in England was writing his own simultaneously. So when he got this book, he wrote it up and made corrections and things like that. The very next year he publishes the book next to it, which he hand-makes wallpaper. So it's wallpaper, he does the calligraphy himself, he makes less than 100 of these copies and sends them to people, including Yeats and Pound and so on. And he never republishes these poems, and there's 8 of them in the world, the volumes of this book. Incredibly rare, but what it shows is 2 visions for modernity. And what's really interesting in the Arthur Whaley archive, when you look at his personal library, is that you can also see his revisions of Giles's work, or Giles's work, which is the Victorian translator of Chinese into English, who always, he's a versifier, so he always uses meter and rhyme, but more importantly, he used a vocabulary which was legible to English readers. And when Whaley crosses out and marks in his book, you'll see things like tranquil repose being slashed out, and then a new word be put in, void, tasteless. And he's not critiquing it, saying this is tasteless. He's saying that's how you translate these Chinese words. Tranquil repose, void, tasteless. So he onboards kind of early, you could say, proto-existentialist, Buddhist-tinged, modern form of trans-Pacific consciousness that's really not yet scaled. People would not know what to do with these things until much later, post-Beat generation. You know, like that kind of stuff is really, you know, these are tinged with a kind of Buddhist idea that could see void as being positive, tasteless as being good, tranquil repose, the connotations of it sound so pleasant. The other one, there'd be no taste, the way for them to understand that that's actually a positive, right? Until post-World War II, the kind of introduction of Buddhism to American psychology and pop culture. Today, I think we could read that as positive, but it's extraordinary to see a mark in a book in around 1915-20 like that. Looking at his dictionaries, we can see again, you know, some of the words that he would go to, but also indexing, which is, I've yet to break the code. It's really complex and very weathered, but it's interesting to kind of get a sense of what the mechanics of his translation might have looked like. This is just a snapshot, a screenshot from the digital side of the archive, which, so this is the collection tree, so the Tibetan Chinese sinophone writer, Alai. We have a lot of work of his, you know, letters and so on, and you'll see folder 1 correspondence, folder 2, his creative viewpoints as expressed, folder 3 book reviews, then we have some miscellaneous folders. Then we would also potentially have contracts around his work that Howard Goldblatt might have been publishing, how much he might have gotten paid for a particular project and so on. That, then when you click on one of those, it's going to bring up a description of what's in that file, the correspondence in that file, based on privacy issues. The ultimate goal will be to click on that and get the letter, right? Get the digital version of the review and so on. And that is because I'm in Oklahoma and there's not a sense that, you know, everyone is going to come to Oklahoma, but that you don't have to come anywhere. So the digital side of this is essentially to create, you know, to create repositories that Chinese scholars can use from China and be able to get access to the life world of Chinese literature in English. But to do that, of course, is a multi-year, multi-step process. I'll say something about that process first before going to the theory and wrapping it up. And tell me time-wise. I didn't get a timer on it.
1:25.
And how much?
1:25.
When am I?
45.
Okay, is that with Q&A afterwards?
Yeah, Q&A afterwards.
Okay, good. Okay, so I'm here at DC. I went to AES, the Association of Asian Studies, and I went to some eminent scholars in the field, translators of the Yin Luo Su and the Miao people, anthropologists and so on, and I ask them, as I do everywhere I go, where are you putting your papers? And I always have the same response: what are you talking about? What are papers? And it's so shocking. I'm always, of course, somewhat glad to hear that as a collector, but it's also a really scary thing to hear that, you know, you have all of this incredibly important information in extremely dangerous hands, which are the people who make that information. So if I think about myself, I am a very bad self-archivist, because it seems so self-centered and so presumptuous to be like, this receipt I spent, you know, like, oh my God, really? I can't do it. I can't get over that. Whereas, you know, my poet friends and author friends, they do this because there's a payoff at the end. They retire on the value of their literary archives. And, you know, that's hyperbole, definitely. But they do well by selling them. They're not retired, but they can do well, and they know that. But more importantly, just the transactional economic is one element, but if you want to be studied, if you want to be entered into literary history, you need to have this material, because you can't do modern literary scholarship without an archive. And this is what blows my mind about translation studies. So, you know, I go to the archive and I study the correspondence of every person. You know, Ezra Pound kept everything, and so Fenollosa is very well documented, so I'm able to go in and find, as it were, just as a quick side note, that Fenollosa wrote this really important essay that established so many ideas for modern American poetry based on ideas that he had about Chinese poetry. Really important text. Sinologists hate this text, generally, because it had a lot of wrong ideas about how Chinese language works. But a lot of those ideas were from the University of Tokyo, professors who also shared those ideas. So, you know, there it is. But there's this important text that's out there. Everyone knows it. We've been citing it for 100 years and so on. I went to the archive wondering, where's the Buddhism? Because Fenollosa is a Buddhist for 20 years before he writes this. And Ezra Pound's a notorious hater of Buddhism. Did he edit it out? I wanted to know. Like, I want to go to the archive, find the original drafts, and go, where did he edit out the tinges of Buddhism that you would expect to find from the first conversion to Buddhism from the West, for such a long period? And I had read everything else around him, and he was not just a Buddhist, he was an evangelical Buddhist. He was going to Chautauqua Institutes all over America, coding it, but definitely trying to convert people to think in Buddhist ways. Why would it not be in his primary text? And of course it was there. What I didn't know I would find is that there was a second half of the essay, that we have been only studying the first half for, you know, 70 years. We've been studying the same first half of that essay, not knowing the second half was all about prosody, cosmology, and all the ideas of poetics, which are so rich and so unusual to find, and so unuseful to Ezra Pound. He didn't like rhyme, he didn't like meter, so of course he just ignores all of this stuff. Right? So the archive held within it a parallel universe for English modernism, one that didn't happen, but one that's really rich and wonderful. So, I mean, that's my, you know, for me, my career is built on finding things in the archive. And know that without it, you can't really do, it's very hard to get to novelty unless it's theoretical novelty. It's very hard to be important unless you're novel. So, how do you get to novelty? You discover something. How do you discover something? You have to have evidence. Where do you keep evidence of it? So going and finding that this whole strata of world literature is essentially completely uncollected and vulnerable has been a really eye-opening experience. So the first step is to collect the material. The second step is to convince your university to take it in. I was just saying at lunch, the University of California, San Diego charges anyone giving their papers to the university $30,000. So here is everything I have, and I want to be important. Or I want my loved one who's passed away to be important. Or I am the executor of the estate of someone whose other groups in my, you know, in my circle, for whatever reason, need this to be housed in a prestigious institution of higher learning. Pay me for it. Because to bring in these kinds of materials have costs involved, in-kind costs as well as often CAC costs, especially when it comes to the digitization. The queues, they're very long. Housing them in temperature control, you know, most universities do not have significant, public, you know, hard spaces for these materials that are safe spaces and so on. So actually, it's not an easy thing to do, to introduce a new form of something that the university should be protecting. It's not a given that they're interested in it. And part of that is because there is no demand for it. So back to economics a little bit, the sort of scrappy capitalism that, you know, I think that that I see in Taiwan, I see, you know, in a place like Oklahoma, which is not kind of able to rest on laurels. And so, you know, I could pitch the idea that I can raise the metadata of traffic at OU Library if we're getting Chinese traffic, because I, you know, this is going to be, and already is, a highly visited space and so on. So, you know, but it requires that kind of, because there's no proof for it, actually, because it doesn't exist. Okay, so you collect it, you bring it in, you have to catalog it, then you have to index, you know, create repositories that, you know, also require people, coders, programmers. That takes resources away from other projects. And then the digitization queues, as I mentioned, and then there's curatorial efforts. What do you do on the front end? You know, do you run exhibits? Do you create digital curated spaces that are more user-friendly, like you would find with, some of our, you know, Walt Whitman or something, you might go and find it, the archives, a beautiful front end and so on, but very expensive. So so typically I'm working on doing exhibits in the physical world and working on the digitization of repositories and not really doing the curatorial digital side because of its cost, and I think it's premature. Okay. So now, last thing is to kind of wrap our heads a little bit around this. I think these are guesses as to why we're here, why we're in the trouble we're in. So the first one, I couldn't pull up my, again, a cloud problem. I couldn't download my PPT last night, last second of the day. So I had to take a screenshot of this slide. So scholars rarely publish criticism on literary works in translation. And I just want us to think about why. You know, I already mentioned that students, like GAs, won't teach it because they don't feel confident in the material. But why would a professor, a semiotician, for instance, you know, who reads sign systems, be wary of reading and writing on, more importantly, a work of translated fiction? And so I think the answer is this black box problem. So a semiotician is interested in the materiality of language and sign systems. They're more or less trained to believe that the materiality of signification is something that can be studied and understood. But there is a metaphysical problem, which is that the materiality of the text is in the text. It's in another text. It's in the original. So it shows a kind of Platonic hang-up, perhaps, that the translation is a derivative, it's a mimetic representation of an original, and therefore is unstable in its relationship to the referent or to the signified, and cannot in fact sustain close reading. Even though that's what the dissertations do, although typically in that gotcha mentality, you know, but if you don't have the Chinese, why are you close reading a translated text? What do you do with what you find there? Like what pronouncement do you make? You know, the idea that you would make anything other than what you normally do is rather shocking to me. I think a semiotician would just read the book and make arguments that they try to support in the way that they would normally do, but that you don't find that. The siloing of the disciplinary language-based approach to literature is very good in many ways. You know, because we want etymological studies, we want to have research done in the original. But I recently got into a bit of a kerfluffle online, which is what you do online, about a review of one of Moyan's novels that that very clearly didn't read the translation, and the review was of the translation. So, you know, the review being with the cover of the translation, the name of the translator, and they're very different from one another, as you would expect, and yet the reviewer did not take the time to read the thing that they were reviewing, and then was shocked to be called out on not having done that. And again, it kind of shows that there's a sense that the translation doesn't in fact exist in any important material fashion, which is to say, where literature doesn't exist in history. It's a kind of trans-temporal or trans-historical space that that has no materiality and no environmental causation, no no networks, no power structures. I mean, everything we all study and find so interesting about literature and the humanities somehow is just not engaged in a field due to a missing strata of data. That last part is, of course, an argument. It's all an argument. So maybe does post-structuralism has some fault to play? Think about, you know, I teach theory at OU, as one of my main areas that I'm engaged in and so on. I, of course, as a theorist, teaching theory, love theory, but the fact that theory is taught in translation, not referring to the problems of its own translation very often, the fact that structuralism always only talked about the structure of a language from within a language and never from between languages or across languages, right? The idea that a phoneme is the same thing, transcendental for every person who sees a letter or something like that, and no one deconstructs anything from outside of the language itself, shows a pervasive monolingual bias in critical theory, whether it's francophone, anglophone, or sinophone. But the space of interlanguage is untheorized, essentially, from the ground up. So when one has this bias and you're dealing with a material text that has no referent that can be found through the empirical evidence, you know, given that it's in another language you have no access to, maybe. Because if you go before that, you actually find a lot of translations being read and talked about. So think about existentialism for a moment. Think about Lu Xun and his generation and how scholars across different languages were writing about them all the time. Right? Because they were sharing certain kinds of discourses and you would not be able to read that language, but you would still include that author in your discussion because you could not do without it. You needed the Japanese author in English or in German. You needed the German in English or French. You know, not everyone's a polyglot, but there was not a kind of embargo on reading translation. And of course, part of this is basic territoriality, that if I try to write on a book that's in a language, you know, a translation, and there could be a moment of embarrassment when the original is referenced by someone in that field calling me out as a debutante, you know. You don't belong here, get out, you know. But if you don't have that, it means also all manner of critical theories are not being introduced into the study of world literature, because critical theories are typically circulated within their own language systems. And so you don't get that cross-fertilization that that I think would be so vital. So that when Moyan came out, you know, as this winner, and people were trying to understand his work and talking about you know, magical realism and these terms which have a very loose relationship to, you know, to, I mean, he definitely had magical realism as part of it, but not having a vocabulary to talk about the Boxer Rebellion and the metaphysics of surrealism, what that might mean when you're talking about radical ruptures in linguistic and cultural signifying practices, you know, because that's not one's area. Well, it is, you know, could have been their area. It's an interesting book, but I think you just end up having a really impoverished sense of what critical theory is if it's not reading across translation. And so then translation theory ends up being part of the problem in itself, because of course to be an expert in anything means to be conversant in hermeneutics and Schleiermacher and all the way up through Venuti and understand, you know, how to talk about translation. So it's also policed. So if you come in without being a translation expert in theory, then it sounds like you don't actually have the chops to be in the conversation to begin with. And so theory ends up sometimes replicating itself. That's almost it. The last one is back to the capitalism stuff, which is around the power structure. If you are a collected person, you're a culture producer, your papers are collected in a research university and being cited. Your papers, not your publication, your manuscripts. What do your colleagues think about that? You know, like when your metadata starts showing people are not just reading your book, but reading how you made your book. See the shift? There's a prestige shift in register, and that could very well create a degree of parity between the creative writer, whose metrics are based on readership and, you know, and this kind of attentiveness to their body of work, but also their personhood, their historicalness. Right? The translator shifts from scholar's space, metadata as referencing ideas, to metadata referencing practice and the social historical forces within one's own life. That shifts their space from worker, labor worker, you know, which is essentially often untenurable and gives you lower marks in terms of production and most criteria, to some new space, right? Because you can't deny if it is happening that you're getting this kind of feedback. So promotion, tenure, metrics. And finally, if you have something that's of value, you get paid for it. If you don't, you know probably you don't get paid, and you'll likely have to pay. So if if this isn't changed, if no one wants translation materials, then you will be paying that $30,000 to put your materials into a university. But if people are using it, then universities will want it, and if they want it, they will pay for it, and translators will start getting paid. Once translators are paid, I tried to run this experiment with my book series, but it was a little too complex, and it was a fail. I also tried to raise grant money, and I couldn't do this. I wanted two paychecks to my translators for their books, one for the final product, and one for the director DVD. Right? I wanted their cut. I wanted all of their draft